guess I shouldn't use that line here, I suppose. I'm also given to understand that you had your 25th anniversary of the Pacific Group a week ago, and that seems incredible. That means I must have spoken during the first year of its existence when I was coming back from a research project. And ordinarily I might not have been able to take a talk on short notice, but your fearless leader has a way of making requests. He called to say that he had been in Georgia a few days earlier, and someone had come up to him and said, "Clancy, you're my second favorite speaker." And Clancy said, like an idiot, he asked him who his first speaker was, the first favorite was, and therefore he thought he would call me because there must be something in my talk that he had missed over the decades. And having the night open, how could one possibly reject such an invitation? In fact, I might actually talk a little bit about what I believe, which is unusual. I try to avoid controversy, and also I don't really believe the podium is any place for intimacies. But you know, I was reminded, I've been sober quite a while now, and it is difficult to remember what it was like even to drink. And my wife and I went up to Oregon to speak someplace, and as a switch we thought we would go up on the train. I hadn't been on a train since the war, Second World War. And they now have little compartments, tiny little things. If you're just going for a short hop, you don't need a larger one, but these little ones, it really is just two chairs facing each other, and you can make them into a lower and upper bunk at night, very intimate. And they try to give it a slightly festive air, so when we got on, they gave us a little mug of wine. And I couldn't believe it. It was no bigger than your fist. And it was to allow two people to have a party. You know, the social drinker is a strange person. Now, I wouldn't have bothered to drink that if that was all there was when I was drinking. I literally couldn't believe a little thing like that, and they intended you to actually consume it and then sit locked in a train. But in a compartment or two away from us, there was a drinking man, and he had brought naturally his own supply. And sometime during the course of the night, he became ill. And he threw up in this tiny compartment and then had spent the night sleeping in it and facing the porter the next morning. I think I can explain this. Don't you hate to give up all the good fun you had while you were drinking? Yeah, memories, I'll tell you. In fact, it reminded me of a fellow that we used to know many years ago. He would disappear for various lengths of time and have the most wild adventures and come back and tell us about it. One of my favorite stories, which just reminded me of, was that one time he went up to Alaska and for some reason found employment as a deep sea diver. And he was explaining that where we in the Air Corps and so on would take oxygen to relieve hangovers, according to him, when you took the type of forced air that you get under compression, instead of relieving your symptoms, it makes you ill. And he said that in those old type hard hat suits with a leather and boots, that you control your movement up and down by pressing a valve with your chin. And he said, you really haven't lived until you vomited inside one of those helmets. And then had to rub your face in it in order to come to the surface. It must have been hard for Steve, our first speaker, to give up all the fun of drinking. But I think the idea of talking a little bit differently, I know that the tapes of my last two appearances here will tell you what I used to be like and what happened, so I'll tell you about right now. The royalties on those tapes are very low, at least I haven't heard from them yet. But I was listening to Stephen, and I was thinking how strange it is that in one sense our stories are parallel, and in another they are absolutely different. We react to various external stimuli in different ways, even though we may be the same. I know he spoke of it, and I've heard Clancy and others speak of it, how when things get tough, they would run. And in my case, I could not conceive of running. That would have been a much more brave task than I could have imagined. The rougher things got, the more necessary it was for me to stand there and take it. I think I would, and that's why I believe in, when I do talk about it, I tend to stress the physical aspect of our disease rather than the psychic or emotional, because I am a very disciplined person. And if I thought that there was anything that had to do with my tenacity, my determination, my grit, that would cure my alcoholism, I would be out there still trying it. In other words, whenever I made up my mind to do something, assuming it was within my physical prowess to do it, I achieved it. I have trophies in one of my back rooms that I won when I was racing motorcycles over age 50. Not those flat-out desert races where speed is everything, but what they call enduros, where the idea is to be punctual and be able to stand pain. My alcoholic career has given me a good foothold in that field. I had to quit smoking here some years back because I smoked 2 or 3 packs of Camels a day for 35 years, and I come from the backwoods of Oregon, and there, when you shot deer, we would cut it into strips and hang it in the smoke sheds out in the back of a house in order to preserve it. It's called jerky. If you've ever eaten jerky in a bar, you will have some idea how your lungs are developing. And I burnt my lungs up, and I had to quit. And no big deal. You get on your knees and bark like a dog for a week. And really nothing to it. But I could scarcely move at speed for half a block. By speed, I mean a fast walk. But they told me to get into running in order to try to recover some of the damage I had done, and I celebrated my 60th birthday here a few years back by running a full marathon, 26 miles. Now, I'm not talking about this as something to be proud of. It's simply a matter that what I'm trying to get at is if alcoholism had to do with a lack of willpower or discipline, I wouldn't be an alcoholic. You know, sometimes the non-alcoholic world will say of us, you people lack willpower. You know why they say that? They think we want to stay sober. If they had any idea of our true goal, they would stand in awe at our dedication and perseverance. What do they have? They will pursue to the gates of insanity or death, huh? Candy asses, that's what they are. So, it was vital, imperative for me to come to understand that, as our book tells us, the one thing that distinguishes the alcoholic from the non-alcoholic is the phenomenon of craving that results from taking the first drink. Other than that, nothing. I have never had an emotion that non-alcoholics haven't had. The things that we suffer from, they suffer from. It is physical. And as a result of the fact that only one person in ten has the fortune, good or ill, to become an alcoholic or to be an alcoholic, the other nine can't understand it, nor can the one. And so they talk to us in idiotic ways. I know here recently I've been mentioning the idea that during all of the years that I smoked, no one ever asked me once the questions they asked me about my drinking. In other words, no one ever came up to me and said, "Don, why did you start smoking? Was it lack of self-esteem? Did you have a hole through your stomach through which wind blew? Are you the adult child of smoking parents?" Of course not. Everyone knew why I started smoking. Because when you're about 13 or 14 and you want to look grown up and mannish and rakish, by God, you smoke. That's what grown-up, mannish, rakish men do. Now, the fact that when you pass a junior high school and see a kid hitting a cigarette, the little punk doesn't look good about you. Know, but he doesn't know that. And if you have any doubt, look at any motion picture made during the 30s when I grew up. Every male lead smoked. It was de rigueur. You had to smoke. Paul Henry lit two at once, gave one to a lady, and got laid, just like that. You ask me why I smoke. And in those days, a woman who smoked would do anything. Never dawned on us they would continue until they became gray-haired grandmothers sitting on a bus stop. Mother. And I doubt that anyone has ever come up to you and asked such a question, because 10 out of 10 people take up smoking for that reason. And has anyone ever been asked, anyone ever come up to you and said, "Why, my goodness, Bill, it's only 10 in the morning, you're already smoking. Do you smoke when you get out of bed in the morning? Do you smoke when you're alone?" Because they know anyone who smokes for more than a few weeks is going to become hooked. And once hooked, he's going to smoke every 15 minutes, approximately, for the balance of his life, until he dies or quits, whichever comes first. But the alcoholic, they ask those nutty questions. They wouldn't talk like that to other people who have problems of alcoholism, only in a different field. No one ever comes up to a diabetic and says, "Look, Bill, I'm not a WCTU, I'm not a blue nose here, I don't ask you to give up candy. I just suggest you take two or three bars like I do, and then don't go into a swoon. Don't go into one of those damn comas." And only until I realized that this was the case, that to talk to me about willpower in regard to controlling booze, or to talk to me about my emotional or psychic problems, as long as I still thought that I could whip alcoholism by discipline was a waste of time. Because when I first came around AA, I was not powerless over alcohol. I was an alcoholic, no question about that, but I wasn't powerless. And our first step says that we admit to powerlessness, not to alcoholism. Hell, I admitted I was an alcoholic 10 years before I quit. Read the AA book and I identified it. But I thought forewarned is forearmed. And it was true. I would come out of a courtroom and the other counsel might say, "Good Lord, what a day we had. What do you say we stop and have a beer?" And I'd say, "Well, I can't. Today's Tuesday. I have to be back in court on Thursday." Because I knew once I started drinking how long it took to get on a good one and how long it took to get off. And while you may be wasting time and money and causing odd looks from your colleagues, you're not powerless. The only thing is that alcoholism is a progressive disease and your power gradually subsides. Soon I could no longer guarantee I was going to make it to a given date, and I certainly couldn't guarantee when I was going to stop, even though I knew. I remember the height of my drinking. I was the chief trial deputy in the district attorney's office for a very brief period. And on Monday morning, it was my obligation to interview those people who had fallen from valor over the weekend. And, you know, and in those days, there were very little drugs. There was some 30 years or more ago, and almost every one of them, therefore, was involved with alcohol, because all crime is directly or indirectly connected with alcohol or drugs. Doesn't matter whether it's robbery, wife beating, bad checks, auto theft, rape. Well, that's not true. With the alcoholic, it was always attempted rape. I remember that. That's one of the tragedies of the disease. It afflicts the ladies, too. You know, they go into some bar looking for a knight in shining armor who is going to whisk them out of the west on his white steed. And by the time their knight has sufficient chemical courage to enter the lists, he suddenly found he's lost his lance. You know, and it becomes as a disappointment to everyone. But being Monday morning, they would be sitting on the opposite side of my big desk, shaking, trembling, and wondering what the future held. And being Monday morning, I would be sitting on my side of the big desk, shaking, trembling, wondering what the future held. Because I couldn't see with the material possessions that were in the way, such as houses, cars, wives, children, names on doors, that this could be powerlessness. And I did not understand the idea that it was physical. They used to say in those days, however, that alcohol in small quantities will remove spots on clothing, and in larger quantities will remove clothing. Still larger quantities will remove houses, cars, wives, children. Pursued long enough, it will remove the drinker. But if you stop just short of that, when all else is gone, you will be able to see the horizon rather plain. And it was necessary for me to do that. Because, as I say, you know, let me have that. I ran into something the other day. It's astonishing how brilliant I find things that I agree with. This had to do, specifically, they're talking about slips, and they're saying there's no reason to charge the slip to alcoholic behavior, or a second heart attack to the cardiac behavior, and so on. And the point of this bit is that the author says, in any event, the psychology of the alcoholic is not as different as some people try to make it. The disease has certain physical differences, yes. And the alcoholic has problems peculiar to him, perhaps in that he has been put on the defensive and consequently has developed frustrations. But in many instances, there is no more reason to be talking about the alcoholic mind than there is to describe something called the cardiac mind, or the tuberculosis mind, or the diabetic mind. I think we'll help the alcoholic more if we can first recognize that he is primarily a human being afflicted by human nature. Now, that's a quote from Dr. Silkworth, the fellow who sobered up, Bill Wilson, and was in the grapevine in 1947. Now, I wish I had read that sort of a thing at that time, because I thought in order for me to get sober, I had to admit to some sort of wild and crazy mental aberrations. And I was not, in other words, when Steve was reminding me, he said, I'm going to law school. I went to law school and I was a practicing alcoholic. I drove a taxi cab at nights. I had a wife and children, and I was the top of my class in law school. I went on such a drunk shortly before the bar exam that I had to check into a hospital where they fed me intravenously until I was able to get up and go in and take the bar exam. And I passed it so high that I got a secret letter that I was in the top five people in the state of California. I couldn't imagine running from anything. I had to sober up and stay there and fight it. Therefore, it was only when I realized that determination or grit has absolutely nothing to do with controlling your drinking. Meaning, it would be like saying to someone, look, eat a box of X-Lax and then exercise moderation. It therefore became possible for me to quit drinking. Now, that doesn't mean that it is as simple as that. When I quit drinking, I was left in the condition I was in when I started drinking. Now, Steve hit on that. He began drinking when he was 13 or 14 or whatever it was. Exactly the same way with me. I began drinking when I was 15. Now, alcohol is a great preservative. You put a specimen in a bottle of alcohol, come back a decade later, you will find it unblemished and pure as it was when you left. You put alcohol into an adolescent and come back 10, 15 years later, and you will find him exactly as he was when he left. Because he will have grayed, wrinkled, been educated beyond his intelligence perhaps, but emotionally you have that adolescent. And as near as I can tell, though I thought too, I suffered from grievous disorders when I arrived. I used to think, yes, I was twisted like a young sapling and I've grown into a gnarled old oak and you can't save me. I suffer from disorders for which science hasn't even named the cure. As near as I can determine now, the sole thing I suffered from when I got here was immaturity. I was, because when we talk about being unhappy in our teens, we're not describing alcoholism. We're describing adolescence. Puberty is a form of insanity. The idea of a happy, if you were to say, yes, he's a happy, to use the expression, a happy, well-adjusted adolescence is an oxymorism. I throw that in, Clancy, in case there's anyone here from Malibu, they like those kind of words. it's true, the point of our talk is to communicate an emotion, not an intellectualism, and so I do try to work in words. When I'm speaking out at the Palisades, I will perhaps say, AA is essentially an eleemosynary organization and our traditions are its incorporeal hereditaments. Now, they have no idea what the hell I've said, but they're impressed. On the other hand, when I'm speaking out in Pomona, I try to work in the word manure. Yeah, he's a big shot, all right, but by God, he's country boy at heart, you can tell. My greatest moment, I think, was speaking at a meeting in West Hollywood. And my wife and I had gone and run those 10K runs on the weekend, and because of a specific reason, we had run one called Run for Gay Pride the previous week, and I'm speaking in West Hollywood to this group, and I wore a white shirt, but under it I had on a chartreuse sleeveless shirt that I had gotten that said Run for Gay Pride on it. And so, during one point in my pitch, like Clark Kent in a telephone booth, I suddenly ripped off my shirt and stood revealed in my chartreuse singlet. It was the closest thing I've come to a standing ovation. but an adolescence is crazy. And we learn through the pain-pleasure principle. Once you take any chemical, you break that pain-pleasure principle. You cease to learn. We teach our children, we teach our animals, we teach old men like me, by inflicting pain when you do wrong, by reward when you do right. Now you take chemicals and you get instantaneous reward, instant euphoria you didn't deserve, and which will leave you feeling guilty. Also, when you do something wrong, evil, erroneous, antisocial, you don't pay the price. You take some more of the whoo-wee, and you avoid the lesson. It is possible to remain repeating the same exact mistake indefinitely, as long as you have chemicals. I don't know whether... Steve mentioned that if it hadn't been for chemicals, he might not have survived. I don't know what I would have done absent chemicals. I have a feeling that I might have grown up. I'm not sure. I don't know. Maybe I would have killed myself. Suicide is a leading cause of death among teenagers. It's a horrible period. They're suffering the absolute agony of the damned, and they are totally lacking in a background against which to portray and picture and visualize their problems, and they have no command of the English language sufficient to share it. My children, when they were going through the testosterone rush, I mean, the boys, they were like Greek gods. They'd get a pimple and their life was over. The girls were worse. They would come home in tears, and I would say, "What's wrong?" And they would say, "That boy, what did he do? He looked at me. How did he look at you? Funny." "Funny? What do you mean, funny? Lewd, lurid, aggressive, hostile, funny? What kind of funny?" "Funny, funny!" I mean, youth is the most horrible period of life, and they're suffering the agonies of the damned, and they have no way to describe it. They have no command of English language, but they speak in primordial grunts, and right at that moment, I began drinking. You know, and I hear people in AA often get up and say, "What we alcoholics are, were people born without copers." Now, that's a phrase that if you reflect on its syntax will make you vomit up your sleeve, but more importantly, the implication is non-alcoholics are born with copers. No one is born with the ability to cope. Look into a little crib. Look at that infant in there. You think he can cope? Every form of life learns to cope by being frustrated and then having to deal with it. And you deal with it sober. If you run from it through chemicals, you don't learn. You haven't learned to deal with it. You know, I hear people say, "Oh yes, when I drank, then I could dance, could talk with the girls." I heard Mike Rosh, and he was about 6'6", say, "When I drank, I was the same height as everyone else." That's nonsense. No one is improved by drinking. When you drink, you do not become articulate and witty. You become thick-tongued and stupid. Now, it's like those crazy commercials that are on TV now about the silver bullet. See, the liquor industry is spending millions, multi-millions of dollars trying to hook the young people now on booze. And, you know, the silver bullet. The night belongs to Michelob. Have you ever been in a beer and wine joint? If you want to see what life would be like if everyone had a prefrontal lobotomy, stop into any beer and wine joint. No. Down to a dog with the three bimbos dancing around. I mean, yeah, that's utterly insane. And the strange thing is that all of those commercials are geared to us because we are the true consumer. They've done statistical studies. 8% of the people who drink, and that isn't even all the alcoholics, where about 10% drink over 50% all the beer, wine, and whiskey made. The next, I think it's 7%, drink the next 35%. All the rest of the alcoholics and heavy drinkers drink something like 85% of every bit of spirits made. So we are the true consumer, and yet we're never mentioned. We would, you know, sometimes you'll see a thing like Jim Beam saying, if you can't handle your drinking, leave it alone. If we all quit, we would bankrupt the industry. Right like that. Bang. There's no industry alive that can lose 85% of its market and survive. You wouldn't pay to print a label for what my non-alcoholic waters drink. I don't drink at all. I drink almost as much as they do. And yet we are never mentioned. You know, I remember back earlier on, they used to have one that really fascinated me. It was by Gallo, I think. It had to do with the Napa, Sonoma, Mendocino counties. They had discovered somewhere a secret stock that they called a private stock. They had come across at one time, and they decided to share it with their friends. As near as I could tell, they had about 30 million friends, because you could buy it in those days for 58 cents a Mickey. And I'm in favor of altruism. I'm not opposed to it. And so I was glad they were sharing, but what got me was they portrayed what apparently was supposed to be the consumer. It was a man in a tuxedo sitting across a candelabra-lit table from a young woman in a formal. And they were drinking this product. Now, I wouldn't want to disillusion anyone who has faith in American advertising, but the amount of Gallo Ruby Port drunk under those conditions you could stick in your eye and never impair the vision. If they'd wanted to show the true consumer, they would have begun with a pan shot under the Broadway Bridge. Here comes a guy down, staggering down there. You know, he's done a yeoman job of getting himself buttoned up. His fly has almost reached the top, failing only through reasons beyond his control. He's got a paper sack clutched by the neck so you don't know what's in it. He parts the reeds, and there in the grass is his lady there in a print dress she got when she left Camarillo. And he says to her, "Here's the private stock." I think he'll be amused by his presumption. Well, they are occasionally truthful, of course. They had one, I remember, that said, "There are times when only a beer will do it." Now, God knows, no truer words ever passed through the portals of the mouth of man. The only thing was, they accompanied it with a picture of a guy trout fishing. And he caught something, and then he saw him cutting it, and then it was frying, bubbling in the pan, and then they sat down to eat this little fish, and the word was, "There are times when only a beer will do it." That's true, but that ain't one of them. I mean, a beer might possibly go all right. I didn't mess with finny fish creatures when I was drinking, but if they'd wanted to show a truth in advertising, it would have again started with a guy coming out of his bedroom on Monday morning. His eyes are red balls of flame. There's hair on his jagged teeth. He would drink his children's blood if the alcohol content were high enough. He opens the refrigerator, there's one burger. There are times that only a beer will do it. I don't know if it would sell. And by the way, it may seem like while I've been up here, I've been attacking the alcohol and liquor industry. I assure you, I am not. Everyone talks today of the horrors of overpopulation, and the tobacco and the liquor industry are the only ones striving to do something about it. And I am not. I would never criticize. So I got here anyhow. Eventually, I realized I had to quit drinking because I was physically different than other people. And then it finally dawned on me that I had better take those steps, because they too are like X-lax. Faith is not required. You take them just as you would take a box of X-lax, and faith follows, as it were. They work, whether you believe in them or not. Because what they are designed to do is to achieve a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening. AA's godfather, William James, in his book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, went out and analyzed the troubled souls of this world, the twice born, he called them, who were deep in the grape, St. Augustine on down, and something happened to them. Rare, revolutionary things. And they were so dramatic, they seemed to come from without, because they were beyond their power to command or control. And it changed their lives. And he was interested not in what they said caused it, but in what mechanically, materialistically, had happened before that led to it, and then what they did subsequently. And he set out in his varieties, which he called varieties of religious experience, but he defined, as our book notes, religious the same way we just define spiritual. And what we have done in AA, in essence, is mass-produce them. We mass-produce these miracles. Like Henry Ford and his production line, they would start at one end with a chassis, and they added parts as it went down the end, to the end of the line. There were always cars being made, but they were handmade, and they cost so much the public couldn't afford them. This way, they rolled off at the end of that line, cheap and plentiful. AA, we do the same thing. You start at step one, and you go down the assembly line. They're numbered, by the way, to help the intellectual. You go down the assembly line, and you arrive at step 12, which says, having had a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening, not prior to, but as a result of those steps. And then life becomes good. It really does. I don't want to terrify, I know there aren't many newcomers, I wouldn't want to terrify you by indicating that this is a life which, if you undertake it, is going to bring you joy. I know no newcomer ever wanted joy, comfort, peace of mind, contentment. What we want is cause for complaint, justification for failure. But you can get to the place where you can endure pleasure. It is not that bad. You can be hardened even to delight. Freedom from ennui is tolerable in time. And lest you give up all hope, I will say to you that you are also going to know moments on this program that are so painful you cannot yet conceive of them. It's going to curl your hair what's going to happen to your hair, because all the things that flesh are heir to are going to continue to happen even though I stop sucking on the jug. The world didn't rise up on its tippy toes in order to avoid upsetting my psyche. People are going to reject you, abandon you, not fail to appreciate you. Injustice is going to be worked upon you. And you're going to stand there and take it, because you're forfeited. You like the chemical peace of mind, and you're going to grow up. And you're going to know a life more free than you can presently imagine. Because this is what life is about living. To the best of my knowledge, I have tried everything I ever fantasized about when I was drinking and couldn't find time or ability to do. Anything I've ever wanted to do, I have tried it in AA. And if you can, because with this higher power, you have the greatest scapegoat ever known to man. In decades now, I haven't made a single mistake, not the slightest faw-paw deviation from the path of dollar or rectitude that I've been guilty of. On the other hand, God has seen fit to do through me some of the selfishness, petty, rotten, lewd, lurid, edict, maniacal things you can imagine. But if it gives him pleasure to make me look like a horse's ass, who are you to criticize? I've taken the third step. Other people say what they tell you is their own opinion. What I tell you is the word of God, and you better listen up. The only thing is, he changes his mind about every week, making me look like a boob for having misconstrued his message the prior week. But life has been good for me. I have had pain, and I've had joy, and always the evil was followed by a good that would not have occurred hadn't I endured it. You know, I married a beautiful young woman who says she likes me. And as I mentioned before, she doesn't object to old age creeping on her at night, which I find pleasant. As we have aged together, I used to delight in the enthusiasm with which she approached her conjugal duties. Now I appreciate her patience. My work is good. I've always been judgmental, and now I'm paid for it. I run into Superior Court judges, and they lower their heads when they speak to me. Oh, yes, Your Honor, that's all what they think you can do. My greatest danger is that I will begin to believe that I have been anointed rather than appointed. Fortunately, I can come to an AA meeting and speak to a group of people where I know that in your hearts, each of you is aware that you are smarter, more intelligent, more sensitive than I am. Where else can I get that? Because this is what, see, I'm now of an age where I know I haven't too long to go. Youth is immortal. But in 50 years, the wink of a celestial eye, everybody in this room, in all probability, will be dead. That's such a short length of time. You know, we rise like bubbles and champagne pop and we're gone. And if we miss this miraculous phenomenon of life because we're on the nod, or because we're sick, or because we're resentful and hostile, what a waste. What a waste. This program is really about living. When you stop drinking or using drugs for the first time in your entire life, you will be free. Like Martin Luther King, you'll be able to say, free at last, great God Almighty, free at last. And you can do anything you want. It's like some God set forth a feast of experience and said, take what you want and then pay for it. And it is wild out there. If there is anything that you want to do to correct some perceived wrong, evil in the world, now is the time to do it. No one raises his arm for righteousness' sake in the tomb. If you want to do something loving, tender, gentle, now is the time for it. The grave, it is a fine and private place that none, I think, do there embrace, saith the poet. And really, if there was anything I could give to people as a result, not of my years on the bench or the powers that the state of California wisely or unwisely gave me, but as a result of the 25 years in AA, I would pound on this podium with this gavel and say, I declare life is now in session.